This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Questions come streaming into us via radio program at AOL.com. That's the destination for questions. Today, I'm with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, known to many of you. She is a registered dietitian, and she is also possessor of a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And we work together on a daily basis solving patients' health and nutrition problems. So here we are in 2017, well into the month of January.
Mm-hmm.
lots of football, lots of gloomy, gray, cold days here.
Yes, very cold days.
Lots of brown slush lining the streets and sidewalks of New York.
Yeah, snow is pretty, but in New York City, it gets dirty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're approaching, you know, it's that kind of gloomy time of the year where there's some statistic about the gloomiest Monday of the year. I think it's the third Monday of January.
Oh, my.
Suicide hotlines light up all across the country.
Third yeah. Monday of January. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're trying to, you know, here's your antidote to January gloom as we... you know, support your health through hopefully helpful and helpful information.
Right.
And to compound your misery, let's start with this. Why not? It's the beginning of the year.
People are,
you know, the New Year's resolutions. Uh-huh. People, some may be implementing them, some may be already faltering. Headline from Science Daily, deeper than obesity, a majority of people is now over fat. Now, that sounds like grammatically wrong. A majority of people is now over fat, but majority is actually singular.
So yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. The pitfall would be to write that sentence. A majority of people are over fat.
Mm-hmm.
People are over fat, but a majority is singular. So a majority of people is now over fat. Researchers describe a new pandemic that has quietly overtaken the world and argue for a change in global health efforts against chronic and metabolic diseases. So what they show here, it's very interesting. It's a pie chart.
Mm-hmm.
And the pie chart shows you look at the pie chart, the overwhelming majority of this pie chart is people who are over fat. Now, this is global. This is not just U.S.
Because wow.
The U.S., you know, we know. But
yeah.
Global, internationally, based on a 2014 world population of 7.2 billion people, 4.5 to 5.5 billion people are over fat. So normalcy is actually now the exception.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yes.
is kind of weird because normal is less common than abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
Normal
mm-hmm.
fat, just 14 to 28% of people, that would be 1 to 2 billion people. So, you know, if you're actually normal fat, you are among the elect in the world's population, a minority.
Yeah.
And then there, of course, the underfat people, 675 to 750 million people are underfat.
Hmm.
And that would be the people who are in poverty. Okay, because we got to say that, you know, world's population is 7 billion. Roughly 10% of the world's population
yeah.
is living in poverty and are hungry.
Right, right.
And that's actually quite a remarkable change from many years ago
yeah.
where half the world's population or more were hungry.
If we just talked about those who are underfat in this country,
yeah.
they would not be the people in poverty.
Because
no. the people in poverty, they would be the opposite.
Exactly.
They would be overfat.
They would be the privileged, the elite,
yes.
the... people with eating disorders.
Yes.
Which is a phenomenon that, you know, if you go to You know, Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of people with anorexia nervosa in Sudan because they can't afford to do that. It's
exactly.
a phenomenon of plenty. Okay,
yeah.
It's a reaction, you know, to overeating, and you know, it's a social mm-hmm. phenomenon within advanced countries.
This reminds me of an article I wrote in the newsletter. It might be due for a reprise. I keep talking about the difference, how the social norm of what we perceive to be overweight or overfat anymore has changed, say, since 1980.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie that starred the late Dom DeLuise in 1980 called Fatso.
Yes.
Now, when you watch this movie, and this is what struck me
it's
and why I wrote about it.
I said, un-PC for 2017.
Well, not just that. He's the normal looking man of today that I see on the subway.
Yes.
He's the majority of men, despite winter coats right now. I'm really talking summertime.
He's not really that obese.
He wasn't.
He's chubby.
Yeah. I think he's no longer living. That's why I say.
Yeah.
So the norm of that has changed. I mean, if you look at people on the subway, who's fitting onto a subway seat anymore? They're taking up two.
No, but we have an atypical view of it because New York, you know, I call
it's
it
different.
The phenomenon is to live in New York, it's the quick or the dead. You know,
yeah.
if you're not quick, nimble, and spry, you can't hack it in New York. So
right.
when I see people in New York, first of all, the fashionable people, the wealthy people, the beautiful people, the mm-hmm. ultra-competitive people, the people of excellence who flood in from all over the United States to live in an urban environment.
Yeah.
But then you go to the hinterland, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm off and running, I go different places, and I marvel at the physiognomy of the average person in a supermarket, for example. Then I look in their shopping cart, and I know why.
That's a big tell right there.
But let's look at this concept, because what does it mean, overfat? Okay, overfat means not necessarily overweight, because contrast that with the BMI, the body mass index, which mm-hmm. is a very spurious statistic, because it's all based on just your height and your weight, and then some mathematical equation is applied to that. And it tells you whether you have elevated BMI, which means you're overweight,
yes.
or if you have optimal BMI, or if you're markedly optimal, elevated, it's you're obese.
Yes.
And of course, you know, the classic example is like a running back for the New York Giants, who might be, you know, 220 pounds and 5'10", just compact muscle.
Right.
But another 5'10", human who is, you know, sedentary, sitting on the couch with a clicker in his or her hand, at 5'10", and that weight would be obese.
Yes.
By the BMI.
Definitely.
So the BMI, forget about it. So the overfat concept is based on roughly that a man should be less than one quarter body fat,
mm-hmm.
and a woman should be less than one third. Women have curves, and they should be allowed to have some body
fat. And those
fat.
Pesky hormones, you know.
Yeah, so, right, exactly. But you got, you know, curves. So, you know, and that's the way it is. And by that criteria, 62 to 76% of the world's population are over fat.
Mm-hmm.
They exceed one quarter for men or one third for women.
Yeah.
And we ascertain this based on a body composition analysis, which we do electronically.
Right.
People stand on a scale. Now they're home versions of these scales, but we have a more mm-hmm. sophisticated version that mm-hmm. costs thousands of dollars. You can also go into a chamber, and the chamber will measure your bone density,
yes.
will also measure your fat content. It's a little more sophisticated way of doing it.
Right.
Or you can do the Archimedean way of doing it, which is to dip you into a pool.
Yes.
I remember as a college student.
That was a gold standard at the Obesity Research Center.
I did that there.
They still have the metabolic
chamber. You and I trained at the same place. We trained at Columbia at Uptown St. Luke's Hospital.
Right,
yeah.
right.
And I once put on a bathing suit, dipped in the pool. I did my body, my fat content based on the Archimedean principle of water displacement, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Fat floats and, right.
Yeah, right. So anyway, is this a useful concept? What do you think?
It is, because it completely strikes down the notion of being a normal weight.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you're a normal weight, if you're over fat,
mm-hmm.
if you're more than, say, 28% fat for a woman, 30%, we really don't like to see more than 30% for a woman, for example, you could be a normal weight. You might even be on the cusp of underweight. Think of that supermodel.
Okay.
Who, say, doesn't exercise or doesn't eat right. They just eat very low calories.
Has
they could still be over. They could still be over fat.
Yeah.
Even though they're thin.
So I think, though, that there's a limitation to this concept because on the one hand, it stigmatizes people.
Yeah.
And people are already, you know, manically obsessed with their weight.
Yeah.
And dieting, which is unfortunate. Because dieting doesn't work. but it also may include some individuals who are relatively healthy.
Yes.
And there is actually a concept, and there's somebody who wrote a book about this. I actually interviewed them a couple of years ago, which is called the obesity paradox. And what they say is that some people who are a little chunky, or, you know, there's a Yiddish word for it, zaftig, you know, which has worked its way into the English language, which means that you're sort of prosperous and you carry a little extra weight, but you know, perhaps you're in good health.
Yeah.
Is it possible to carry a little extra weight and be in good health? Some people manage to do that, especially with older people.
Exercisers.
We're concerned with older people sometimes who are stick thin and frail.
Yeah.
And they may fit the category of, quote, normal body fat.
Yeah.
But they may be less healthy than someone who carries some reserve.
They have too little lean body mass or sarcopenia.
That
needs to be factored in as well. So much of that muscle also in a non-elderly person can be displaced by fat.
I think
if they
that
don't
this concept is a tool, merely a tool. It should be looked at as a tool to help us identify people who are at risk. Because you know, you could easily miss some people who are at risk by using the BMI. You know, because some people, while they don't have diabetes, they don't have cardiovascular disease, that extra fat. And that bad ratio of fat to lean may put them at risk.
Exactly. And you know, the fat, especially visceral fat, is not just a depot. It behaves like an endocrine organ.
Yep. Creates inflammation.
Yes. Inflammatory cytokines. Mm. It can be, it can create more estrogen.
Yes.
Not great if you're estrogen dominant.
Yes, that's
right. Right.
That's a good point.
Could be.
Hormonally mediated cancers.
Right.
And in men, hormonally mediated cancers are associated with excess body fat.
Right.
So cardiovascular, diabetes, stroke,
interestingly,
blah, blah, blah.
Maybe overweight women who are postmenopausal have less chance of osteoporosis, not just because they're literally carrying around that extra weight,
but more
the estrogen secretion.
So there's some slight advantage.
Interesting.
So anyway, it's an interesting concept. You know, we don't need to, you know, now that we've depressed you, let's...
you need a body composition. It's not enough just to weigh yourself.
You're over fat. You're over fat.
Right, right. Okay.
All right, so let's move on to questions.
Okay. We've got an email from Chris. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I just finished reading your excellent article, The Role of Biofilms in Chronic Infections, and found it very interesting. My only question, or perhaps comment, would it be that, why is it that Lyme disease was not covered? I'm curious, and do you see many Lyme patients at your center?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your time.
So let me answer it the back end first, which is that I've deliberately chosen not to see Lyme disease patients unless they're just desirous of the nutritional supplement and hormonal repair that's necessary in the treatment of Lyme disease. I think to treat Lyme disease, it requires a full-on commitment to the emerging science of Lyme diagnosis and treatment, which troubles me because it's by no means settled. I think what we see sometimes is people who conventional doctors say, no, you don't have Lyme. And then if you go to enough Lyme specialists, you'll eventually find someone who will entertain a diagnosis of Lyme disease, perhaps put you on high-dose antibiotics, which may or may not be beneficial. It's actually kind of inconclusive as to whether these antibiotics uniformly help. No question, they help some people. But I think some people who have vague symptoms, you know, they have neurological problems, they have chronic fatigue syndrome, they have arthritis, and as people age, many people develop these problems. And some, you know, they may live in a region of the country where there's Lyme, and now they think virtually everywhere in the country is susceptible to Lyme or tick-borne infections. They can come up with some scintilla of evidence that you may be exposed to Lyme and then treat you perhaps too aggressively or maybe correctly. For Lyme, to me, it's a conundrum, and I don't want to enter into that.
Yeah.
However, coming back to biofilms make it harder to kill tenacious infections. And in Lyme disease, it may be that biofilms help to protect or sequester the Lyme spirochetes, rendering them more difficult to kill. That's one theory of why Lyme disease is so hard to treat.
Let me see if I understand this correctly. Yep. When you have Lyme disease, you treat it with the antibiotic can kill the Lyme infection. However, when it's covered itself with biofilm, mm-hmm. then the antibiotic can't really cleave
right.
that biofilm.
Exactly.
Is that?
Exactly.
And so it gets to hang around forever and ever.
And it also makes the organisms less susceptible to our own immune system. So it's, see, we tend to, when we studied biology, we looked at, peered through a microscope, and we looked basically at maybe protozoa floating around, and we saw, oh, these are little one-celled organisms. They're swimming happily individually.
Yeah.
But actually, bacteria congregate in colonies, mm-hmm. and they link together, and then they secrete polysaccharides, which form a carapace or shell around them. It's not a hard shell, it's actually a soft shell.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it actually enables them to survive under harsh conditions and enables them to evade antibiotics. And it makes many infections much harder to treat, like chronic right. sinusitis, maybe chronic prostatitis, you know, certain pelvic inflammatory disorder.
Mm-hmm.
When you develop a endocarditis around one of your heart valves, or when you develop an infection around a prosthetic device, like an indwelling catheter or something. Those are biofilms are involved. And
yeah.
So I wrote, it's a kind of highfalutin scientific article in a medical journal
mm-hmm.
Called Clinical Advisor. And one of the points about that article is we talk about high-tech solutions and innovative approaches, but we also talk about xylitol, which is a way that you can break up biofilms. But
yeah.
it won't do much for Lyme disease, because drinking xylitol or taking it in food is not going to get to the internal.
And it could cause a whole lot of diarrhea if you
yeah.
take enough of it.
But if you spray it in your nasal passages, it'll break up the biofilms. If
yeah.
you use it in toothpaste, it'll break up the biofilms on the surface of your teeth.
But there are enzymes like interphase, which may be useful.
And that may be more for gastrointestinal biofilms mm-hmm. in conditions like, you know, chronic leaky gut or things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Not necessarily in
And EDTA also may be helpful mm-hmm. for breaking up biofilms, and that's intravenous, so mm-hmm. EDTA has been administered for chelation, but it also seems to affect biofilms. Maybe, and I know some innovative Lyme doctors are using these tricks to try and get at refractory Lyme.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yep.
So, Christopher, thank you for your email.
Yep.
All right. We've got, first of all, two people who have written, both Denise and Wendy, on your very wonderfully informative podcast with Dr. Bongiorno. Now, Denise is asking, great podcast with Dr. Bongiorno, as anxiety affects us all at one point or another, could you kindly elaborate on DHEA supplementation that was mentioned in the program? And when should one get tested for DHEA? And is DHEA sulfate the proper test? Yes, that's the proper test. And
not
what's
just plain DHEA. That's a
right.
mistake a lot of doctors often make.
Yeah.
Is that you actually want the DHEA sulfate tested.
Mm-hmm. I'm a 54-year-old woman. What would you call what would be an optimal level of DHEA for me? And what dosage should I start if I'm suboptimal? And how often should I have my DHEA sulfate tested?
Okay, big subject, and you know it pertains in this case to mood. Okay, so DHEA has been shown in experiments to enhance mood, especially in seniors. Older individuals who may have declining levels of DHEA. It's
mm-hmm.
the most prevalent hormone in the body. It's actually poorly understood. It's thought to be just a precursor to other hormones, but actually it has its own functions, and it works on the brain. It has
wow.
It has anti-inflammatory properties, so we use it in autoimmune diseases. Some studies have shown that high-dose DHEA is helpful in lupus in women.
Wow.
It is something... that can be helpful for anxiety in the sense that low levels of DHEA produce a low mood state. And DHEA is sort of a hormone of confidence and assertiveness. Not quite as to the extent that a testosterone is, but DHEA.
Yet it's the precursor to testosterone as well as many other.
But it's also a precursor to estrogen.
Yeah.
So that's why one has to be careful in administering it to men with prostate cancer or the potential for it, or women with breast cancer or uterine cancer.
Yeah.
Hormonal cancers are a contraindication to the use of DHEA. When a woman starts DHEA, I generally go 5 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we measure it, and
yeah.
it can go higher. In a very serious inflammatory condition like lupus, we might go to 25 or 50. In the study done at Stanford, which showed it was helpful for lupus, they were using 200.
Wow.
But at 200, you can get some side effects. You can get oily skin. You can get acne. Women can get some hair recession or loss.
Yes.
So we don't
receding
like the use
hairline.
Of high doses.
Yeah.
What level is good level for a woman? Well, it depends.
Mid-50s.
Mid-50s is okay, but if we want to really push it up, we can push it up into the hundreds,
mm-hmm.
Up mm-hmm. to there. I don't like to see it much higher.
So for a 54-year-old female, a woman in her mid-50s?
Well, I'd be concerned if it was in the teens or the 20s.
Yeah, that would be quite low.
30s, and if the person were tired, I'd dose it more symptomatically.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not great for bone mineral density if your DHEA is that low.
Exactly.
You shouldn't have the DHEA level of, say, an 85-year-old.
Exactly.
It might be a 12 or an 18 or something like that.
It should be in that range of the high, mid to high double digits.
Yeah. And most of our cases with bone mineral density where we've helped to reverse osteoporosis back to osteopenia, I know most of those cases included some DHEA where you uncovered that the woman was low in DHEA and needed supplementation.
Yeah, and then we can use it as a tool along with other supplements to build bone density.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have the... First of all, it's not a prescription. It's over the counter. It's much easier to administer than testosterone. Mm-hmm.
So what would be natural ways of boosting DHEA? This is the advice I give.
Yeah.
Be an eternal optimist.
Yeah.
Get enough sleep every night.
Yes.
Be on a perfect diet.
Yes.
And be an excellent exerciser.
Yeah, no,
and meditate.
That would help.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All of that can help boost your DHEA naturally.
Right.
So for those who really want to,
No, I think that's good advice. There's actually some evidence, for example, that certain types of exercise boost androgens, perhaps in men and women. In the exercise
squats.
That seems most helpful is squats. It's a very deep exercise. It engages some of the real big muscles of the body.
Yeah.
And so there's actually some studies that show that growth hormone, testosterone, and perhaps DHEA are generated when you do that type of exercise.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you eventually will speak in a lower voice when you do lots of squats. No, I'm kidding. Squats are one of the exercises known to boost testosterone, especially most than any other weight-bearing exercise. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Fascinating.
So we had another question along those lines.
Yes, yes. Besides Denise, Wendy writes, again, loved your podcast with Dr. Bongiorno. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Interested in hormones and ways to boost energy for exercise, like a pre-workout boost, what would you recommend?
Hormones. Well, we address that,
Having DHEA levels.
Yeah.
You want to eat right. You want to make sure you're eating right and to have energy for your workout.
I believe in working out fasting.
Yes. I agree.
I actually think that you get more fat burning.
Mm-hmm.
You deepen your glycogen, depots because the body adapts to exercise on a fasting basis. I think there's some people who tell me they can't exercise unless they've eaten.
Hmm.
And that's a concern because it means that their glycogen depots are not well established. Glycogen is a storage form of sugar in the muscle.
If they're in a fasted state, that they're actually in quite low blood sugar and the exercise is lowering it further, making them intolerant.
I think weak or sick people have a defect in storage of glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, sometimes they feel like they have to eat every few minutes, literally, to keep their blood sugar up.
Right. People in adrenal stress and all that.
Low adrenals is a factor there, too.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So we could pause because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. And when we return, give us a preview of what we will tackle.
Is it possible for me to use natural blood thinners for anti-cardiolipin syndrome?
Okay, anti-cardiolipin syndrome. When we return, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and we'll be right back with part two.